My name is Nicole Pucci, and you're listening to Ralph Pucci, the podcast. You're listening to Season 2, and our theme for this season is Power Couples in the Arts. Ralph and I are honored to share the conversation we had with Chris Larica and Gabriella Kiss. Chris is a furniture maker, architect, and one of our longest-term collaborators here at Pucci. Gabriella designs extraordinary jewelry. Several years back, the two designed a beautiful and very successful collection together. To this day, it remains a fan favorite. In this conversation, we discuss their move from Brooklyn to upstate New York, their unique home, how they collaborate, their inspirations, and their heroes. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Good morning, Chris and Gabriella. Thank you both so much for taking the time to chat with us. We're both really looking forward to today's conversation with you. And I know that we're looking forward to hearing about how you two met, how your relationship started, and you know how this all came to be. So Ralph, you want to introduce Chris and Gabriella?
Well, it is a great honor to introduce two of my great friends and someone very important to my career. I started with Chris Larica around 22, 23 years ago, I think. I'm not exactly sure, but I know it's a long time ago. He was the first person after Andre Putman that I took on. So it was the very beginning of Pucci and when the whole vision started to take place. And a cute quick story before we start was around 1989 when I did these little miniature sculptures with Ruben Toledo. He wanted to accessorize them. And out of the clear blue, he just said, I want these jewelry pieces from Gabriella Kiss. And it turns out that Gabriella was Chris Larica's wife. And I didn't know that at the time. And here we are, 22, 23 years later, we're all together and we're going to have this interview. So we're looking forward to it. So what do you think, Chris? How many years have we been together? Is it 22 or 23 or 25? What is it?
I think it's 23 because 23. I know it. It's when we left the city.
Yeah.
And it was part of what made it possible for me to leave the city was our relationship and, you know, having access to that amazing showroom early on and our relationship with these new designs that first show. You know, I thought it was going to be the kiss of death leaving the city. And, and then we worked out a deal and I left and my business tripled in about 3 years. So I was like, well, that wasn't such a bad idea. And I mean, and a lot of the thanks go to you and having that vision. And those were the early years. So it was really fun to watch it take off.
Yeah, it was really exciting times, very exciting times. Tell us about that move from Brooklyn to upstate New York, because that, like you said, that was a big thing for you. And, you know, there's so much publicity now about where you're living, but there you were a pioneer. You were years ahead of your time moving up there. Can we hear a little bit about that, the church where you live? And
yeah, well, I think even though it seems like, it certainly wasn't trailblazing back then. It was just a matter of timing. Our boys were 4 and 6 and we were entering that difficult sort of madness of just finding elementary and preschool situations in the city. And it was such a mess. And we wanted to be in the country. So we started looking in this kind of tri-state area. And the church was a very special place. A friend of ours knew the owner, who was a classical musician. He was a violist, and it was his weekend space. And for Chris, I think just right away seeing a space, it was like, yes, this is it. It's not, we didn't want suburbia. We wanted beautiful nature and something unusual architecturally. And for us, it was the right time. You know, Chris had joined forces with you, and I had enough of a business, established business, that I had the luxury of the choice to leave, which was really great. And it was a great move, I think.
Yeah, no, I think initially she was pushing it more, and then when I saw the church, I was like, wow, this. We had looked at a lot of places at that point, and I was still angling to go back to Brooklyn. And when I saw the church, I was like, I could see living here. This is an amazing space, and it's turned out to be that space that we, you know, initially reacted to. And the kids too, they love that place, and they love coming back there. And it's sort of this center for our social life up here, and that really helped, I think. But initially, you know, it was a large building on a small piece of property, and then we were like, that that's a strange way of moving to the country.
We realized after the first week after moving here, it's like, oh, we bought a giant building on a tiny piece of property. It's supposed to be the other way around when you move to the country.
But we remedied that by keeping an eye on the adjoining properties, and two of them came up in the next 5 years, and we snapped them up. And that's, you know, what became my studio, that 9 acres behind the church, and the fields where I store all the lumber and dry all the wood, and then this smaller house, beautiful older house across the street, became Gabriella's studio, and we were fixing them up simultaneously about 15, 16 years ago. But so it all worked out very nicely. So we have this compound of buildings now that just work really well for the whole thing.
I'd love to hear more about your views on scale. So I know that the church you're in is quite large from looking at pictures. And Gabriella, when I was reading about you, I learned that you spent a lot of time making little scenes in matchboxes. So from a very young age, you were sort of drawn to a small scale. And I'm curious if you could tell us more about that and how you got into jewelry making in the first place.
Perfect question. Scale is enormously important to me, for a funny choice of words. For me, even as a child, I was always drawn to the world within a world aspect of things. So yes, I with my dear friend Lee Hale, who also makes jewelry and sculpture, as kids, we would just spend all our time making little environments inside of these matchboxes. Her mother was a smoker, and we had these wonderful, endless supply of these beautiful little matchboxes. They were called La Petite. That's just sort of been my natural mode of working. And then when I went to Pratt as a sculpture major, because they at the time didn't have a specific jewelry department, I kind of tailored my major to jewelry. And in terms of living space, when we moved to the church, I felt a little overwhelmed. I mean, again, the kids loved it. Chris put a basketball hoop up inside the big room, and they would ride their unicycles around. And it was this great sort of joyous kind of big wow space. But I had been watching this lovely little cottage that's across the street from the church, who had been sort of unused for years. And I kept thinking, that's more my scale. And if possible, I could put my studio in there, would be great, because until then I had my studio space was up in the choir loft of the church, so all of my metal dust and work dust was kind of filtering into our living space, and it wasn't an ideal situation. So when one day I saw the owner, who would just come up once a year to check on the house, and I ran out and said, if you'd ever consider selling this, I'll never forget him standing in the road sort of pointing at this giant building of the church, saying, you have this and you want this. and I did. And it was, but it's been a wonderful thing. I've been able to make the space very much mine. I feel much more comfortable in there. And it's fun as when people come to visit and we give a tour. Yeah, the church is sort of the grand space. And then you come into my jewelry studio, and it's still set up like a home, so I could, you know, it could be rented if necessary, but everything's very small, and I have all my little sculptural things everywhere, and it's sort of like a dollhouse space. And then people come up to Chris's barn, and it's like, again, sort of vast and expansive and wow and filled with his beautiful work. So scale means a lot to me. Again, Chris and I as a couple, it's kind of perfect if we go traveling together. Chris will see the whole building, and I will concentrate on the detail of a building. So somehow between the two of us, we get a really good sense of the whole.
Hey, Chris, I have a question for you. I remember the first time when I saw your work, it was, you know, obviously the pedestals attracted me, and I think maybe even the daybed was out at that time. But how did it all happen for you? Tell me a little bit about, you know, your history. You know, when I met you, you were probably, it was 20-something years ago, so you were, you know, pretty into your career. You had already won some major awards.
Yeah, it was you're probably about 25 years old, 26 when we met, something like that. But natural a path as it was with Gabriella, I grew up in a family where my father was an architect, and a family of architects on that side. So I grew up in this very beautiful house in the woods. So I had, you know, that was in my blood for sure, building and design. And But I'd say, you know, as in my younger life, I was not focused on art so much. It was around me. And I ended up, you know, going to a liberal arts college and anthropology, all sorts of different things. I think a big turning point for me was I dropped out of college when I was about 19 or 20, and I just traveled around Europe and lived on my own for a year and a half. And that really made me kind of think about what I wanted to do with myself. And when I came back to college, I focused almost entirely on art at that point on. And it was a period where I was trying to find who I was. And I think I was moving more in a direction of art or maybe architecture when I got out of college, and even got into architecture school, but was not really convinced that was a good place for me to go with my very physical background. I was very into sports at the time. And so I needed just the idea of sitting at a cubicle for long periods of time would have been a death sentence for me. And around the same time I got into architecture school, I found a job working with this furniture maker in Brooklyn, and that was 1981, I think. And I remember just feeling like I'd found a place that I could really find myself. And it was really from that point on, it was just full speed ahead in that direction of making furniture. And it started off more as like cabinetry and apprenticing the old fashioned way, a cabinet maker, furniture maker. And that lasted a few years. And then I went off on my own and spent 4 or 5 years on my own. And then basically taking on no projects that were not my designs for a while and just focusing on that in the like late 80s, early 90s. And then beginning to show my work. I think in 91 was the first time I showed my work in the International Furniture Fair. And there was a community of people at the time in New York who responded to it, and it just took off slowly and then even faster when we connected. But, you know, it didn't come, wasn't something I was, a direction I was going necessarily early in life, but when it did click, I just went into it full speed. And, it, you know, I have no regrets. It's been a passion of mine since, and I enjoy going to work every day still. So that I feel very lucky.
Tell us a bit more about the show you did at Pucci, where Gabriella, you did the mushroom and insect components of the work. How did that all start? And tell us about how that process went for you too.
It was a great experience. It was funny in some ways. It seemed like such an obvious thing, like why hadn't we made work together before? But I think it's because we both, you know, living on this compound and doing our own work, it was almost too close to have done that before. Is that a good way of putting it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so given the project to do a show together was really fun. It was also really great for me in just a very basic way, you know, having been married to Chris for so many years, and he would say, well, I'm talking about his work, he'd say, I'm booked through January, or, you know, and I'd think, okay, that just means he's busy through January. But actually making furniture, and again, a scale issue, you can only work on a few things at a time because of the size and the space that you're given. So it was like this huge light bulb went off in my head, because I designed some tables too, and some of the pieces that I made, I was finally able to really understand what it's like for Chris to make furniture and the challenges that go along with that. And of course, with my scale, I can be working on 10 or 100 different things at a time, and you never know it because they're so small, they're just scattered all around my studio. So it was a great experience just in terms of understanding his work better. And I'm very proud of that show. I think it came out beautifully. That elm branch cabinet with the mushroom handles it's such a beautiful piece, and still making them, right?
Yeah, the elm branch is one of our biggest hits, Chris, together.
Yeah.
I mean, it still has legs. I mean, that is not going to go away. That's a timeless piece. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece. I think it's one of your best pieces, actually.
Yeah, we're very, no, and we can't go, you know, talk about that show without talking about you, Ralph. That was, you really, you came up with the idea. And I remember thinking, oh, this is, you know, getting Gabriella on board. It's going to be a little, you know, pinning her down is tricky, but you had the idea and we were persistent. And, you know, I remember it taking a little longer than when we initially thought it would, but it was, I mean, credit to you for having that vision. And it was, like you say, I've had maybe 10 shows at Pucci. I would put it up there with one of the two or three best shows I've ever done there.
You know what happens? I mean, we did that. I mean, you know, you were always ahead of the curve. You started, you know, this whole movement of wood, and then people, and then all of a sudden everyone started to do it. So we, you know, we just trying to keep ahead of the curve. And I think you were ahead of the curve on that one. You just got to keep pushing and moving forward. And that's what's exciting. You know, sometimes we hit it. Now time we did hit it.
Yeah, and I never felt that way while I was doing it, but you're right. I mean, I remember being in Bedford Stuyvesant in Brooklyn in the late 80s, and there were maybe three hipster furniture makers in all of Brooklyn then, you know. And then when I left, there were like 3,000, and then we moved up here and nobody was doing what I was doing up here. And the same thing. We didn't think of it as setting trends or trailblazing. It just happened that way.
But also, it showed up in wood availability. I remember Chris was working in Walnut for, you know, maybe it was because there were fewer people working back then, but then we moved up here and suddenly, because of the rise in other cabinet makers, furniture designers, all using Walnut, the places that Chris would get it from, they just wasn't available.
And nothing, and the price has doubled, tripled over like a 3 or 4 year period. Fortunately, it's gone back. Nobody wants wood. If they want wood, they want it not to look like wood. Can you bleach it or ebonize it so it doesn't look like wood? So I remember thinking, oh, I'd never do that. But, you know, times change and it will swing back. The aesthetic, I think there'll be a more soulful approach to design again coming up. Right now, it's very, has a very much of an 80s feel to me, which is not what I really came out of so much. I was more reacting to that period in a way that I wanted to move in a different direction, even though it's the period I came out of.
Yeah, well said. Well said.
It's clear that nature is a big part of both of your work. Tell us a little bit about how you are inspired by your property and what do you do to sort of be in touch with nature each day?
Yeah, we're so lucky to live in such an incredibly beautiful place. It was great moving up here and having two young boys. They were trained from an early age to bring me good, you know, specimens, like a good dead bug or finding little snakes and frogs and all that sort of thing. So I think that was my happy place as a child, was just playing in the woods by myself or building little houses by the stream. And so that's, again, even, you know, going on walks, I'm zooming in on the path. I always come back with things in my pockets that either become jewelry or are inspiration for pieces. So it's just, yeah, it's our environment. And Chris, as we drive around, I'm always a little nervous because I've been nurturing this garden behind the church that used to be just a thicket. And now it's basically a woods of walnut trees. And there's not a bunch of plants that will not grow around walnuts because the trees release jugloan, which is a somewhat toxic component. Anyway, I've been planting my ocean of white narcissus in there, and every now and then Chris is wandering around eyeing these beautiful giant walnut trees.
Don't worry, I've got plenty of walnut. I would never touch those trees. They're amazing, though. I mean, they're like 36-inch diameter. They go for 40 feet without a branch. I mean, they're some of the most beautiful walnut trees I've ever seen. But I have no interest in taking those down. Don't worry.
But also the elm branch. I think that the standing dead elms is what is providing the sculptural branches for the elm branch cabinets. And it's sad because, since we've been up here, all the elm trees are dying. So you can see them quite clearly as you're driving around, these sort of silvery ghosts of trees that are
dying. What's nice about elm is it, you know, unlike we have a blight now of ash trees, which they get looking pretty hopeless very quickly. And the elm trees will, because they have a very rot-resistant wood, they'll stand dead for 20 years. And they're just these beautiful ghosts of trees that I've been admiring on my drives and bike rides. And then when you take them down, they're completely solid inside. So they have this, on the outside, this, you know, ancient look, and the inside, they're completely usable lumber. So it's been an interesting process, you know, collecting a lot of these trees and taking them down. And I do like to honor these trees that are, you know, not going to be with us much longer. I mean, the elms, the blight has been going on for 100 years, so it's not a recent thing. But with the ash trees, it's very sad. So I've been trying to work in ash quite a bit just to honor these trees that they'll really be gone to a large extent in the next 10 years. So, but yeah, just being influenced by nature, it's a huge part of my work too, because I work so much in wood, and my designs and shapes are inspired by the shapes of nature and the forms of nature as well. So it's really nice being up here and having that every day.
What else inspires you besides nature?
Well, for me, it's also a combination of my background in design and my love of architecture and history of design, and whether it's, you know, Western design or primitive design, African, Asian, love just discovering new periods of furniture and design over the years and seeing how that, you know, I can relate that to what I'm doing. So, you know, a lot of the lines that I've done for Pucci have been inspired by, you know, very specific part of a period of architecture design, like the last show we did together, the Weimar show, with the Bauhaus influence on my work. And there was a whole Chinese collection when I was really fascinated with the history of Chinese chairs and design, and in the early shows with the African and Shaker references. I mean, clearly also, the 40s in Europe with Charlotte Perriand and Prouvet, and, you know, a lot of those designers who I admired them early on in my career. So it's, you know, a combination of people often will look at my work and think it's strictly inspired by nature, which it is, but it's also inspired by my love of the history of design and building.
Hey, Chris, last week we did a podcast with Christian McBride and his wife, Melissa. And I asked Christian, who was his hero? And he said, obviously Christian's a bass player, and he said, Ray Brown. And if you had to say you had one hero or two heroes that influenced your work and your style, who would that be?
Well, that's a tough one. But I mean, a couple that come to mind are Tapio Virkkala, the Finnish designer, and his ability to go from one material to another. And there's something about Finnish design that really resonates with me too, because it's very sophisticated on one hand, but also just so connected to nature that I think is true of most of Scandinavian design, but more so the further you go north, and in Finland in particular. So Tapio Virkkala is one. Charlotte Perriand would be another. Just her simplicity of form and what she was doing at that time, and, you know, in design as being a woman too, you know, and excelling the way she did. One of my highlights of my career was that in 1997, when I was awarded the Young Designer Award at the Brooklyn Museum, I got to spend an evening with Charlotte Perriand. It was her first time. She was getting the Lifetime Achievement Award, and I think you were at that, Ralph.
Fabulous. Yep.
It was really, you know, just such a privilege to be in her company, and the fact that she had never been to America, and she was, I think, 90 years old at the time. So she, you know, another Hans Wegner, Shakers, there's probably a handful of Shaker women who, you know, influenced my work in a big way. I think it was a Shaker woman who invented the table saw. I don't know what I would be without that. Anyway, the list could go on, but those are a few.
Well, that's great names. That's fantastic. I think it's great for the audience to understand that, because it gives you a little bit better feeling to what you're all about.
Gabriella, who are your heroes?
I think if I'd have to name one, it would be Ted Muehling, who was my mentor. And when I came out of Pratt, Ted had just won a Cody Award And then I got the chance to work with him, and it was just the two of us for my first 8 years out of school. And it was an amazing experience, because not only was I learning how to make his work, but also running a business. And we'd go out and go to museums all the time and have lunch, or the TV was always on in the background. It was just a complete, and I'm so influenced by that experience. I have the same setup in my studio. You know, neither of us have ever worked at a jeweler's bench. He doesn't come from a metalsmithing background either. He was an industrial design student. And I think that's part of his genius, is that he has a vision of a form, and he comes to it in a very organic way. And it's not about metalsmithing techniques being applied to an idea. It's more about the idea coming to fruition on its own. And he truly is, he's my hero. He's a genius in terms of how to make essence of a form, all of his designs, I think, and also just very kind person and dear friend. And so I'd say, he's my top of my list, but also many influences from art history. I'm a lot of my work is about having a narrative of some sort, telling a story in some way, which is not there's no specific hero behind that, but in terms of inspiration, there's...
Gabriella, where can people buy your jewelry? Where would it be sold?
They can come to my studio directly. That I'm in the city at Ted Muehling's shop on White Street, and then there's a handful of stores. I've kept my business very small because I've learned what I'm capable of handling and still keep it in a manageable realm. The places are all listed on I have an incredibly minimal website, but it does list the places that carry my work. So,
and the work is so beautiful. So all of our listeners should definitely check it out. A common question we like to ask is, what advice do you have for someone who's trying to enter the field?
Follow your heart and give it time. With furniture, you have to be in it for the long haul, and don't be deterred by financial restrictions, because you just have to know you love doing it and work. You just have to also be willing to wear a number of hats. I've watched so many what I thought were like success stories not really make it and surprise me, and realize that, you know, you have to just be willing to do a number of things to keep this going and keep your dream alive and not get discouraged. If you can make it, it's a beautiful way of spending your time and days. So I feel, there were times early on where it felt like it's going to be a difficult profession to navigate, but, it does pay off if you work hard and, just put in the time and make some sacrifices. I'm sure.
I would add to that that in my experience, I think for many makers of any type, that you're sort of compelled to make something. Like you're a medium for your art. And I've always found that if I have an idea for something that comes from like, oh, I really want to make this, that's always the thing I have to follow. Only a few times have I ever thought, oh, I need to make something that will sell. And that's never been, for me, it's never been a successful process. So the impulse should come from love and the desire to sort of let these ideas come to fruition. And it's such a different time now to start making something than when Chris and I started, because of course we were pre-internet, and now I hear that people start businesses just on Instagram, and that's kind of great and amazing that that's possible. So in some way I think Chris and I are dinosaurs. We've started at a different time, but that's, for me, I feel like it should be about the work. Have the work, have real integrity and in every way, and process and thought and execution and design, and it should take care of itself from there. I find if you make something of real quality, it will be appreciated.
Yep, well said. And what do we, Chris and I, we haven't seen each other for a while because of this We spoke via email a few times, but is there anything you're working on, or you're thinking about where you want to go next?
No, I've been very busy, because the studio is a little bit smaller. It's quieted down a bit, but I've been doing more myself, but I've been keeping busy, not necessarily big ideas, but, I think there was a 2-month period where I was working pretty much alone, just on the lathe, making smaller objects, which was really fun. And speaking of scale, working at a much smaller scale for the first time, which was similar shapes and ideas, but it was good for me to just bring it down like that. I'm still always thinking of new pieces and collecting materials. The inspiration comes unexpectedly. I'm not really consciously working on any new show ideas, but new pieces are coming out of just the day-to-day existence up here and working with new materials and coming across new things.
There's something kind of great about being told unequivocally that what we do is non-essential. And it is non-essential. But
I could have told you that.
But after a while, I mean, it is essential to us and our livelihoods and who we are. But there was something, I don't know, I think it was at least in the beginning, this kind of the big pause, a time of taking stock. And I couldn't, for the first 6 weeks, I couldn't work. I mean, everything had shut down anyway. And I decided to clean up my studio. And I came upon this old hooked rug that was upstairs in one of the little bedrooms. And I thought, oh, I'll fix this. It was really old. It was frayed. It was a mess. And it took me 6 weeks and I trashed my hands because thimbles, who knew, right? I don't know. And it was also a very heavy texture rug, but it became this beautiful sort of meditation. It was like I was having a conversation with the person who had made this over 100 years ago, and just the act of taking care of something instead of making something to sell was a really sort of beautiful contemplation. And I had thoughts of doing more of that kind of thing, but then the reality of trying to stay alive comes back. But I'd like to keep this slower pace, the kind of preciousness of what the slower pace means, and we'll see. I mean, such strange times, right?
Well, it seems like both of you have managed to find a lot of beauty in this difficult time. And we're very grateful for your time today. We appreciate that. And we hope to see you guys before too long.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, always good.
You guys are two originals. And it's very unique that two people are creative like you are, and but true originals, not copycats in a world full of copycats.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation with Chris Larica and Gabriella Kiss. To learn more about them, you can visit chrislarica.com or gabriellakiss.com. Also, check out their collaboration on our website, ralphpucci.com. Stay tuned for our next episode and have a great day.